You're listening to Resonance FM.
Good evening, welcome to the first of a series of shows on the Frieze Art Fair taking place this week at the London Regent's Park. And I'm your host, Ferry Bradley, here on Resonance 104.4 FM, joined by an esteemed panel of gallerists from across London and artists. And we're going to be discussing our own opinions of the Frieze and what it's bringing to London as an entity. So just to start, I'm going to let each of our panellists introduce themselves, a couple of short sentences about what they do and what's brought them here, so that you, the listener, can identify which voice is which name. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm Stuart Semple. I'm an artist and a curator, and I look after the Aubyn Gallery in Redchurch Street.
Great, thank you.
I'm Cynthia Corbett. I'm a gallerist with a home gallery based in Wimbledon, and I'm the founder and organiser of the Young Masters Art Prize.
Okay, great, thank you.
I'm Nathan Engelbrecht. I'm the co-director of Avonflow Gallery in Shoreditch.
Hi, and I'm Chris Hammond, and I'm the director of MOT International in Brussels and London.
Yes, gone from East End to Brussels. Great news. Great. So I just thought I'd open up by looking at the Frieze as an entity. I mean, some people say, you know, it's brought a lot to London, but we didn't have anything before. But, you know, I've travelled abroad, been to biennials. You must have been to a couple of biennials. What do you think about us having just an art fair? And we don't really have a biennial, do we? Chris, well, maybe you could open.
Well, I think it'd be interesting if we did have a biennial, but I don't know quite when it would fit into the calendar at the moment.
Is that the art calendar?
Yeah, globally, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean, in that sense, I suppose Frieze came out of nowhere. We didn't really have an art fair in London, so it could happen in London also.
Hmm. So basically, if a city wants to launch a big global initiative, it has to see where it's going to slot in, not clash with the others, as you would put when you were putting on a night in London.
Yeah. Or make something bigger and better than at that point in time.
Okay, so we're going to steal the audience from somewhere. Okay. Now, surely there must be a month for London. We can do what Roman emperors do and introduce a new month in the calendar.
Yeah, I guess so. It has to, coincide with other cultural events or good weather times, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. That's true. What about you? What do you think about the...
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm just saying now about the weather is a big deal. I mean, you know, you took a Venice Biennale. I mean, that is a whole kind of outdoor event, and London being as it is, that is probably quite tricky to schedule that in. But I mean, I think for us, I mean, especially as a gallerist, I mean, it's important to have something like Frieze rather than the Biennale for the moment. Mm. You know, as a young gallery, the mass of collectors it brings through is so important for us that I think maybe we might get lost in the noise with another Biennale, especially with auctions on the table.
And then what are we looking at? I mean, because when we look at art at a fair, it's very commercial, it's very hard-hitting. You know, there isn't the celebratory aspect, the art for art's sake aspect that's there with the biennial. So thereby, are we kind of cheapening art in London by just having a fair and not celebrating art as we would in a biennial? I have to ask the devil's advocate question. Yeah. Cynthia, go ahead.
No, I think that's really, really an interesting point. And I think that's one of the amazing things about Frieze. Of course, it is a commercial art fair. It has to support itself, and it has, you know, wonderful sponsors as well. But the initiative of Frieze was so exciting because it has projects, it has many ancillary avenues to it that is celebrating art, not just in a commercial way. And I think that, yes, you could potentially have a Biennale in London, but I'm not really sure it's necessary. I think that's one of the reasons why Frieze has kind of responded to the way it has, and it's growing, and, you know, using, you know, the initiative of Frieze Masters next year. It's, you know, it's really trying to grow and evolve into something that is accessible to the, you know, to the art world at large and also the general public.
Hmm. Perhaps those ancillary avenues that you're mentioning is how we've all first encountered Frieze. I'm not sure. I mean, Aubyn Gallery is relatively small, is it? How would you say?
Yeah, I mean, well, we've got 3,000 square foot, but we're a young gallery, so we've been going just over a year now. But, you know, I think the thing is, what's exciting about Frieze is it brings that sort of... I don't know, it brings a lot of people to the city at the same time, and you see a lot of projects springing up around and throughout the capital, and I think that's really exciting, and a lot of those projects do go above the idea of commerce, I think, you know, so maybe yes, Frieze is a commercial sort of proposition, but there's a lot of very interesting and exciting things happening elsewhere at the same time.
It's usually those satellite events that you're mentioning that are quite enjoyable and more accessible to the general public. What's your experience of satellite events around the Frieze? I mean,
we were involved in Zoo many
years
ago.
Yeah, Zoo. I was going to say Zoo, yeah.
Which was fantastic, especially when it was at the Royal Academy. Yeah. And also, I mean, this year we're involved in Frieze projects with Law Prevost. So again, that's a non-commercial aspect of Frieze, which is fantastic.
How is it non-commercial?
Well, it's funded by Frieze Foundation, which is a separate entity to Frieze Art Fair. So that's a charity-based foundation. So the money comes from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Or the money comes from Frieze, but it's put back into something that's non-commercial.
They're not selling anything. It's not for profit.
It's not for profit, no. Okay. The projects are worked with the curator, Sarah McCrory, and the artists.
But certainly Zoo, I mean, when residents, we had a booth for about 6 years inside the Frieze, we would always pop out, go to the zoo, collect lots of audio, see what was going on there, come back and broadcast it from the Frieze, which I thought was cheeky. But then, you know, Frieze, you know, they have a very benevolent attitude to those satellite events, I think.
And yeah, I think it's really important.
Yeah, and you see everybody sticking it in their opening headline, you know, as a sort of companion to the Frieze, you know, and sort of subtly insinuating that they're a partner of the Frieze, and why not? I mean, if it's going to draw more people.
Of course. I mean, and this year there's Sunday, which happened last year, which is an invite-only fair organised by young galleries from across Europe, which is, again, although it's called a Sunday art fair, it is slightly less commercial, maybe. It's
Oh, is that on the other side of the river, just?
That's right,
in the, where they have the Chelsea Flower
University
Show.
Westminster buildings. I mean, that's another alternative that's perhaps taken the place of Zoo.
Mm.
On a completely different context and grounding as well. So it's not trying to do what Zoo did before. I think we lost a lot of satellite fairs, which was good, really, because there were some not such great fairs popping up around Frieze at that time. A bit like Miami, which is perhaps not so great. But
I don't think I saw any of those not so good.
No, I never went to them.
I went out of pure ignorance rather than disdain. I didn't know that. Okay, what about you? What do you think, you know, because Ebb and Flow's been going for how long, a year?
Yeah, around a year now. Mm. I mean, I think one of the nice thing about Frieze is also not only the other fairs, but also what other galleries do. I mean, you look at, like, say, like Lazzarides last year doing these big kind of shows in the Waterloo Vaults.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that type of thing, I think it gives it a Biennale feel because it's a bigger than usual show. It's more exciting things going on. So I think in that sense, the subsidiary events on the galleries themselves is quite important because we know there's a bigger audience this time.
Hmm. What kind of audience are you getting?
A very, very international audience. Of course, the audience is so international because Frieze is on the calendar just like Basel. And just like Miami Basel, which was one of the reasons why when in 2009 when I launched the Young Masters Initiative, the Exhibition and Art Prize, we did that to coincide with Frieze. Mm. And this is a non-for-profit venture as well. And we initially, for 2009 and 2010, we were at the Old Truman Brewery. And this year we're at an Old Master Gallery in Kensington Church Street, and it gives the artists an opportunity to hang alongside old masters. And this kind of initiative, you know, it would be possible anyway, but, you know, you get a lot more attention during Frieze Week, Frieze Month, Month of London.
The Art Month of London.
Yeah.
Art Monthly's month. Have you heard of this event that Cynthia's been putting on?
Yeah, I have, it looks very interesting, actually. Mm. And I think it's important, you know, to encourage that new talent. And again, to ensure that they get that visibility during a time where that international kind of clientele is in the city. And it becomes part of quite a diverse programme of quite exciting things that are going on. you know, like the thing in the old Vic tunnels that Lazaridis is doing again this year, actually, which looks really good. And Saatchi teaming up with The Future Can Wait for the first time to
What's
show
that
us.
About?
The Future Can Wait have been doing a show normally in the East End since, I think, about 2007. And this year they've teamed up with Saatchi and Channel 4's New Sensations to take on a 22,000 square foot space in Bloomsbury Square, which will be like the largest sort of curated show during Frieze. And I think that's an exciting way to see some new talent as well.
Again, it's outdoors?
No, it's indoors.
Okay, well, whereabouts in Bloomsbury Square then?
I don't know, some big building, I haven't been there yet.
All right, okay. Well, that's part of UCL, isn't it? So there must be a church or something?
No. I'm unsure.
Basically, go to Bloomsbury Square and look for signs. Look for posh people walking in one direction. Cynthia, tell us a little bit more about your project, because I didn't know about it till I got your email. Yeah.
Well, in 2009, it came under the auspices of the gallery, Cynthia Corbett Gallery. We launched our gallery in 2005, and it really, the initiative came about because myself and two other curators were looking at young artists, and we kept seeing really interesting artists that were celebrating craft and technical skill, and we thought it would be an interesting idea to look at the art historical canon and see what was happening with young artists, with contemporary young artists at the time. And we approached different entities to get sponsorship, and AXA Art was our principal sponsor in 2009. So we launched the prize. It was independent curators, independent judges, and we got a fantastic response. We had 16 artists shortlisted, and the in the end, two artists shared the prize. One is a young Spanish artist who trained at the Royal College of Art, named Hector de Gregorio. And the other artist winners were Ghost of a Dream, which I'm sure some of you have heard about, because it's an artist duo from Brooklyn, and they use lottery cards. Used lottery cards to create their installation projects, and the winning installation was a dream home that looked like the inside of a Victorian living room.
Wow!
And it was really it was really fantastic. And they've gone on now to all kinds of great things. We were invited to do Volta New York and Volta Basel with them, and they're up for all kinds of residencies and prizes. So it's a really great initiative to assist young artists to be seen more. And we've toured the project. We're going not for profit, because really the gallery didn't make any money on it, but some of the artists sold. And next year we're going to have a prize, and the judging panel is chaired by Godfrey Barker, the art historian. So it's evolving all the time, and this year it's not a prize, it's just artists getting to respond to the old masters. And
good show, lots of initiative. That's what I'd like to hear. Yeah, so it's becoming an established date, really, your prize?
I think so, yeah. It's October, November every year. And we would have liked to have had the prize again this year, but it was just really difficult to get sponsorship. But we wanted to keep the whole idea alive. Mm. So we're having, various exhibitions. And we've toured. We've done a big project in Bologna last year in a 16th century church. Mm. And that was really exciting during Atafieri. And so, it's kind of an evolving international initiative.
It's difficult with prizes, isn't it? Because they tend to be monetary based. So you want to give someone an accolade, but you have to find some money because the accolade itself isn't enough. Sometimes they get an opportunity that they wouldn't normally get. So, I mean, if you have a gallery space, you could offer them some space. Say the Ebb and Flow couldn't get the cash to give a prize. How would that be regarded by artists in general? Would it be considered?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, especially with a young gallery like ourselves, who support young artists. I mean, they want to be associated with the space. So we're looking at something next year where we're offering the downstairs of our gallery as a residency, and then the residency becomes the gallery space. So you take the walls down, and that's the show. Mm. So I mean, for us, that's an opportunity rather than a monetary prize. Mm. And on the same page, I mean, I think the bigger prizes, yeah, they do have monetary value, but it's more that the prestige of the prize. You know, if your artist is getting something like the Threadneedle Prize or the Turner Prize, for the gallery and for the artist, it's more important than that just small monetary value.
More important.
Yeah.
Would you agree, Chris?
It depends on what the prize is, yes.
Yeah, it depends which gallery space.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there was something with an Iranian artist last year where they got them a 3-week slot at Saatchi.
Right.
Which is pretty, you know, major for an Iranian artist, mm-hmm. to show solo like that. But the money always helps, doesn't it?
Of course, yes. Yeah, so I mean, the economy of artists is it's quite low, really.
And it's the common problem, isn't it? You know, you're too poor, you want to dedicate your time to what you love, but unfortunately you're tied in. So how many responsibilities have you got? So
exactly.
Can you get... How do artists generally... how do they respond to patronage?
It's always difficult, I think. Obviously, artists being artists would tend to... don't want to compromise on things, so it's always difficult. But good patrons, good collectors are those that understand the artist practice and don't allow them to compromise and don't ask things of them that they wouldn't want to do. So they, we have a few of our artists are doing residencies with foundations in Europe, and the foundations work with us quite closely in terms of talking about what the artist will need on that residency and how they can help in producing a piece of work. And obviously they get something from it, and the gallery gets something from it, and also the artist gets something from it. So it's just working out negotiations that suits all parties in the best way, really.
And of course they need their upkeep, don't they, while they're here?
Exactly, that, yeah. Yes.
I remember that, yes, there's that. So Auburn has a lot of space.
Yeah,
have you adopted any artists yet?
Well, we're representing 3 artists at the moment. Although we've had obviously quite a big exhibition program now. I think we've had about 14 shows to date, and we've just sort of taken that step where actually some of our artists are getting busier and really need to lean on the gallery for a little bit more support in terms of negotiating with other galleries and again organising the residencies, things like that. So we're kind of at that sort of moment at the moment where we're kind of doing what they need us to do, I think.
So creating your programme around their needs?
Well, partly, yeah. And I think, you know, the wider sort of curatorial remit of the gallery is to show innovative international artists that are quite young but have a sort of track record, you know, that maybe you haven't seen in the UK yet. So bringing things particularly to East London that maybe you wouldn't find. So we're not just sort of looking on our doorstep, really.
Regular study trips, do you?
Well, not me personally, but the gallery... A sort of artist liaison does, yeah. So she's out and about looking for interesting things to show in the gallery all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting because Stuart and I actually met on the bus. I wasn't going to tell you, but that's how we met. I fag-ended on his phone call, and then I was like, you must come in. And interestingly, when I looked up your gallery, you've got a lot of musical interest. There's a lot of music based, well, perhaps just in your artwork.
Yeah, I think that's more my world,
world
than the galleries. But
About button is all about your world, isn't it? When I clicked the About button, it was about Stuart Semple, and it had a video of your music.
Oh, well, that's on my website, yeah, okay. On my art website, yeah. But, I mean, I'm not even mentioned on the gallery website, actually,
okay.
At all. So, no. I mean, I collaborate a lot with musicians in my practice. That's
okay.
What I do. So,
well, I'm only asking because, obviously, at Resonance, we're very much interested in sound. Mm. And always I'm going around Frieze with my ears open to see what's going on. And, interestingly, they have an award that they give every year, the M-Dash Award. And that's been given this year to an Iranian artist who's showing a piece based on the sound of the rooftops in Iran, but there's no sound in it, and so it's just TV installations. And once I worked with Laura Favoretto, who did a sound intervention. So, I mean, sound in the Frieze is a bit of a problem because it is basically an outdoor ambience, and so any speaker-orientated noise is going to be compromised, probably. What do you think about sound as an art form generally, all of you?
Last year we did Frame as part of Frieze and with Laura Prevost, and a large element of that installation was sound. So it was, as I understand what you're saying there, it was
did
very
you have
hard
trouble?
Well, we were asked to turn it down a few times, yeah, so which was and then the artist would come back and say, can we turn it up? So it was constantly trying to negotiate those levels within the fair.
Yes, lighting and sound is always a big problem.
Exactly,
people are complaining
yeah.
about the strip lights after a few days.
I think people get seasick with the floor going up and down and white out by the white light. It's like snow blindness.
It's an amazing thing to do, just to construct this building and then take it all down again, because you know all the things that go on within it, and then you know a week later it's disappeared. It's amazing. So what kind of experiences have you had with sort of sound and lighting at the Frieze when you go?
I just wanted to touch on what you were saying earlier about artists that we've got in with sound. Is during the Venice Biennale, we've got an artist, Alessandro Libre, and basically he transports sound from Palermo, from the busiest intersection in Palermo, and blares it over Venice, because that's the one thing that Venice doesn't have is traffic. And so that was great, but we could, as again, we'd gone into a lot of trouble all the time. We had to, first we had it for a month playing 24 hours, then they realized what they were saying, then we had to cut it down, so then it only went for a 12-hour period overnight.
They
so
realized what they were saying?
They realized what they were agreeing to by blaring traffic over for 24 hours for a week.
Yeah, I saw that. I loved it.
Thank you.
I thought that was just so fantastic.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to swap sound. We did a swap with a field in Wales with another busy location, and we kept tuning in and listening to sheep.
That's good. Lovely.
Sheep are quite noisy, actually. So was that during the biennial?
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Great, well, I'd love to hear that. So you saw that, did you?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. It was so fantastic. It was really, really fantastic. Mm. So innovative. I loved it. I think there's a great challenge with mixing different mediums generally. We've exhibited a lot of video artists, and that's always quite a challenge as well. And whether it's sound or the actual moving imagery. And sometimes we've done Artissima and Arco and Volta with video art. And it can actually, it's a real challenge.
It's really tricky to get it right.
It's really tricky. And the I would say that one of the best things I saw in Venice this year was in the Iraqi pavilion, Ali Asaf. He was just incredible. And I think we're going to try to be doing a project with him.
What was he doing at the Vienna? Tell us all.
Well, of course, it would. I would love it because it really fits into the whole looking back at art history. He did a project. Well, the whole basis of the Iraqi Pavilion was about water. And his work was Narcisco, and, of course, based on the very famous Narcissus. And the man looking into the water and seeing his whole life flow by, but in this case it was debris. So in it was basically rubbish, and it was just the most moving, most beautiful thing.
Yeah, it was interesting. The whole Iraqi pavilion had these very ecological overtones. So they were looking at water being the essence of life, and obviously in that area, in that zone, we should say, traditionally they used to worship the elements. So water was one of them. And they were all concentrating on what we're doing to the planet. So it's interesting when we have one of these international events where we get a voice from some faraway place. I mean, that was only the second time Iraq have ever shown in the biennial in history. So we need those voices. What do you think? I mean, it's an interesting point that brings up about always the same galleries, the same voices perhaps, or the same kind of choices being made unconsciously by different galleries. So we're getting a repetition year after year, as opposed to important voices that need to be heard. How have we been able to combat that, and how much are we frustrated by that?
Well, I mean, quite often at the major fairs, you tend to see very similar work. And that's something that really frustrates me, whether you're at the Hong Kong Art Fair or Frieze or whatever, and I suppose that's sort of delegated really by the commercial aspect of the work. I mean, the gallerists have paid quite a lot of money for their stand, and at the end of the day they're there to sort of sell their wares, so it's hard sometimes to find those really sort of innovative ideas actually within the fair. And it is frustrating for me. I get a bit kind of blinded by it after a while. Oh, another Julian Opie, oh great, it's a Warhol, But as I say, I think outside the fair, we're seeing some really interesting voices coming through. I mean, at Aubin this year, I've got Yasem Sazmaz's work. Fantastic Turkish artist. She's doing really well coming out of Istanbul. And she's just making some really, really fascinating sort of sculptural works and playing with the space of the gallery in quite an interesting sort of innovative way. So, it's there, but I think you've got to make the effort to go and find it, perhaps.
With innovation, we find that it's there for innovation's sake sometimes. Sometimes innovation is a natural product of that artist's individuality or the individuality of where they come from. So, I mean, it's a bit tricky for a gallery you know, to choose something and say, okay, this is new, we haven't seen this before, but then people come along and go, oh, this is just being new for new's sake. So where do you draw that line? I mean, that's another line.
I mean, you know, I just artists shouldn't be questing for the next new, great, different thing.
Well, it's in music, it's in every form of creativity.
But I mean, at the end of the day, what do you really see that's new, you know? I mean, that's a debate we can have all day, but the point is, you know, when I'm thinking about Yassam's work, the beautiful, tactile, lovely sculptures that she's made out of lindenwood that describe a personality that I haven't seen before, you know, that really moved me. And I think at the end of the day, if a work of art moves you, touches you at that level, it has a sort of spiritual aspect to it, that there's no doubt it's valid.
So how often do we get moved at the fair? Just at the frieze?
I think the frame section is really interesting, and the projects again. There's lots of fantastic installations happening in there with younger galleries.
Oh, tell us a bit about the frame section.
I mean, well, last year we did frame, and obviously we were very involved in that with our own space. So,
what is it? Tell us if we don't know.
It was started 2 years ago, I think, 3 years ago now, and it's a single artist application area for frieze, which is selected by curators rather than by other galleries on a committee, so it's a bit different in that respect. And it's completely to do with the project that you apply with, rather than whether or not the fair wants that gallery in. So it is based upon the actual application for the project, the curated project, in a way.
Okay, so what kind of things have they been coming up with?
Well, I can only really talk on my level, but yeah, I mean, we showed Lord Prevost last year with an installation that looked at the inside of a film. So inside the booth were was almost the elements that existed within the narrative structure of the film, and there was a hole cut out of the front of the booth where the film was projected through from the inside to the outside. So you literally saw the film coming towards the booth, and you entered inside, and you entered into the narrative structure of the film.
You mean the setting?
Yes, exactly.
So that you walked into the set and you were on the film suddenly?
You weren't in it, but you were in the studio that it represented, and you could see the elements that existed within the film, or you could, you know, interact with the elements that were within that.
That's an idea been taken up by Secret Cinema quite a lot.
All right, okay.
So each time they screen a film, they have a sort of sprawling set with actors and people. I mean, it's not, they don't, I think they consider it artwork as much as Laurie would. And it's not, you know, in that context, but they've taken that idea of, you know, experiencing the film and putting yourself in the position of the characters a little way.
I mean, from that, it helped her career. She's from being a recent graduate from Goldsmiths to she's shown in many museums this year, just from people seeing the installation there. So in that respect, it does, it's good in terms of on a professional level, in terms of curators coming around to see the fair and looking for
innovation
like we were talking about before. So it's not just about the Julian Opies and the Andy Warhols.
So we'll all be heading to Freeze Frame this year.
Yeah, no, Frame's good.
Yes.
And I think actually it picks up in a kind of a way from where Zoo left off. Mm-hmm. We miss Zoo terribly.
Yeah.
And it was great. You'd pay £10, you get to see the elephants as well. So, yeah, sadly missed. But no, Frame's picking that up a little bit, I'd like to think. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly, for me, one of the most interesting sort of areas of the fair as well.
I mean, the fair. Did you two want to say anything about those points before we?
Oh, I just think it's vital that Frieze has Frame and the projects area, and that it's independently curated and supported. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to be one of the most important things going forward, I think, for Frieze.
Do you think it's facing challenges with these not-for-profit sections that other people in the art world are facing with cuts and...
Of course.
Yeah. How do you safeguard stuff like that?
Well, because I'm trying to raise a sponsorship right now, I'm sort of on the firing line of this. And, you know, there's always... patronage has supported arts throughout art history. You know, you've had, whether it's, you know, royal patronage or... financial, banking or whatever, but there is a real fight now to, for the limited supply of funding, given the economic crisis that we're in internationally. So the more that an institution like Frieze, who has a lot of financial support from Deutsche Bank and from the galleries that are the big, big, huge galleries that are very important and very successful. That's going to be, you know, fantastic for young emerging artists and innovative projects, and for London.
Because the not-for-profit parts are usually the ones that get chopped off first, aren't they? They're kind of like considered the non-productive limbs because they're not bringing any revenue.
Yeah, I don't know, though. Art fairs really need those parts to be the best art fairs. If you talk about Artisma, which is a fantastic fair because of the quality of the work and the involvement of institutions within that framework. So, and it's also one of the fairs that's directed by a curator or ex-curator. So I you know, it's again with Basel, Statements is a section that people go to and look at for, the next generation of artists and museum shows come from that part of the fair. So they are the most important parts of the fair in some respect. They're the heart of the fair.
And you need to be supported to do that. Because we were bringing, for instance, the Ghost of a Dream project to London in 2009 for the Young Masters, we had to rebuild an entire house. And that cost £10,000 just to get the material here. So thank God we were able to get the sponsorship to do that. But you cannot do something like that and, you know, guarantee you're going to sell it. And you can't even, I mean, obviously it would have been great if it was sold to a museum at this point in their career. It wasn't going to happen because they just weren't known. So it's wonderful if you can do those sorts of things and not have the total pressure of having to sell, because
I think it's an issue that doesn't even touch younger galleries or smaller galleries. I mean, it touches the auction houses. That's why the auction houses are all selling the same stuff. They're all pushing Warhols, all pushing Richters. Even, you know, see with Phillips has been changing their program completely. So it's not only just the small things that you need, the guarantee that you speak about because of the climate. So it's affecting everything. And that's why when you say you see junior RPs and et cetera, they'd have to guarantee it because they've got those same expenses. And unfortunately, that's the reality right now.
But I think we're seeing quite an interesting area in the funding situation, actually, where sort of brands are coming in and sponsoring projects in quite a different way than they were before. So they're not seeing it purely as a sort of advertising mechanism. We're seeing some quite interesting sort of collaborative things between art projects that you couldn't realise. I mean, I just curated a show at the Old Vic Tunnels, actually, and I worked with a whole remit of quite big brands, actually, to bring in the money because, you know, for instance, Ellie Reese's video work that I showed in the tunnels, that cost £6,000 just for the screens and the projector. You know, how do you go about doing that? So you do spend a lot of your time in these kind of backwards and forwards meetings with almost corporations, really, trying to get the art side balanced with the finance side, with what they want for their sort of pound of flesh or whatever, you know.
How did you manage it then? Did the screens have a little yellow M in the corner?
No. No. When you came in, there was a very subtle... It was a brand similar to that as you walked in on the right-hand side, quite small in vinyl. But, you know, I think the brands are understanding they need to sort of sit behind the artistic activity, actually, to be credible, rather than kind of own it.
Because
or the good ones will.
By remit, don't they have to have a philanthropic arm?
I think they need to be seen too, and if they... But, you know, how much they really mean it is another sort of question, I think.
But if the money's there, do we really ask how much of their heart is there?
You quite quickly work out how much of their heart is in it because you start asking for more and more elaborate things, and actually they're like, well, that's crazy. Tessa Farmer's going to put a dead magpie in a house with a load of wasps around it. You know, there's a point where they'll sort of run for the hills. but yeah.
What do you think? Are we on the right track asking for...
Well, I mean, there's cultural capital, isn't there? So, I mean, it's what a corporation allies itself to. They're making a bet in the same way that will produce as much cultural capital as financial capital that they put in. So, I mean, there's obviously the cool factor of backing the right artist or horse or whatever you want to call it. But,
And we've had Tate UBS weekends.
Exactly. So. And they become extremely successful in their own right.
You have the BP Portrait Award.
That's one of the most
BP is a massive company.
Yes, but you remember the protest not so long ago, and then there was these two sides to some artists saying, well, they paint with oil. You know, you love oil. Oil is part of our lives, and other people are saying, you know, it's difficult. But then there's another trend which I've been, you know, hearing about since about 2007 even, where arts organisations and not-for-profit bodies have been adapting to become kind of enterprises. So there's this kind of interesting adaptation, instead of just trying to hold on to the few available funds that Cynthia was mentioning, is also, you know, you grow and change with the times. So they've started looking at having different branches that can make money. You know, as a station here, we're a registered charity, so we think about these things from time to time. Mm-hmm. So I think that might be a burgeoning side of the arts in now that we haven't quite seen the full side of. I think it's going to grow and grow, and that's my prediction for the future. You know, you're going to have your gallery front and your projects, and on the side you're going to have your shop and maybe something else.
Oh, you have to, yeah. Mm. I mean, there's no question why National Gallery has their own restaurant and their massive gift shop. I mean, that is you need that cash flow. You know, it's a reality, unfortunately.
But I mean, there's nothing bad about the National Gallery restaurant, is there?
No, it's a great restaurant.
I'd much rather eat there than I'd much rather give to them than one of the chains they'd have to go begging to sponsor something if they didn't have
Fair
it.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So has anyone got any? Cynthia's looking shocked.
No, I'm not shocked. It's just that I was actually on a panel last year at Crunch, the Hay Festival, and the panel was what is the relationship, or is there a relationship between art and money? And I was obviously.
I bet you're on fire.
I was on fire, but not everyone on the panel was.
Oh, what were they saying?
Well, a lot of people on the panel were saying, that art should be altruistic, and that, no one should have to worry about money, and that it's just, you know, everyone should just celebrate it, and so it was really very naive.
Very naive.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, it's sometimes you do. I have a lot of sleepless nights where I just go, oh. Know, can I get in bed with that entity that's offered me money, or do I not? And then you have to sort of make your own judgments accordingly, and because sometimes what they want is too much, and so then you make that decision as well. I mean, I'm talking about sponsors and that sort of thing. But
I was just wondering what kind of things they'd been asking for that would have been too much. No, mm-hmm. Don't say.
Or how should I put this? Or what they do in their activities.
Right.
And ethics. Sometimes you have to just say, no, I'm not working with that. And you just go back to the drawing board and you know, work with someone else. But you can't be so altruistic or nothing would get done. Because, and unfortunately, particularly in the economy we're in now, and in London is the most expensive place. Mm. Well, I find anyway. I'm American, but I've been here for 25 years.
No, it's been revealed as such recently on a kind of international poll. It's very expensive. I mean, the travel.
And, you know, even with all the economic problems, the rents are still so high, the rates are still so high, and sure, you can get, which I've done a lot, I have various pop-up spaces, which maybe I get for a song or borrow, so you can do that, and you can, be innovative about it, but it's a lot of money to operate in London.
Perhaps at that panel they were looking at the extent of the profit margin, so perhaps they weren't looking at it as in, you know, to say, oh, the artist shouldn't get any money and the gallery shouldn't get any money to exist on, but perhaps they were thinking about the profit margin, you know, when you go and buy a really extortionate, because the inflation of prices is something that a lot of people enjoy at the Frieze. They go there and they're just counting the zeros and they're looking at the artwork, and there's this voyeuristic aspect of the transactions that goes on. And I think that's something that, you know, if you're not in the market, it's quite difficult to justify. You know, or perhaps, what do you think?
I think that's the exception, though, not the rule. You know, most artists actually earn below the minimum wage, work more hours than most people, maybe have two or three jobs. You know, it's not the case, actually, that some big Russian billionaire is sweeping up everybody's work. It's just what the media likes to talk about. Mm. And actually, it's a big distraction from what's really going on, which is the fact that there's a lot of people making a lot of great work that we don't really get to hear about.
Well, surely that's the imbalance that they're looking at as well, as saying, look, this one's gone for, you know, £40,000, £100,000, and this one can't even sell for £300,000.
Yeah, I mean, that imbalance is there, but I think it's important to understand that the economy in the world that we're actually in, you know, that's not to say, oh, art shouldn't be about money. You know, we've got to realise that it absolutely is, and we need those funds to do what we have to do. I mean, I had a two-tongue Jake and Dinos Chapman sculpture to get into a tunnel underneath Waterloo the other day, and it doesn't cost nothing to get the art movers to bring that in so that people can see it. And you know, and that's the situation that we're dealing with on a daily basis. So, you know, that's where we are. And unfortunately, maybe it doesn't trickle down like people think, you know, that someone does buy rich dirt and then all of a sudden the gallery starts backing a whole load of sort of new talent. Maybe it doesn't do that. Maybe it should. I don't know.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think this goes back to what we were originally saying about Frieze, is that it's an access to people who will spend money on that level. You know, £300 is a lot of money for the common Jones Street to buy for something they're putting on their wall. But for these guys who are coming to Frieze, that's nothing. £10,000 is nothing for them. So that's why Frieze is important, is it gives access for artists to be able to sell their work. And especially for such young galleries like mine and yours, it's a case we get access to that, and it justifies us showing that art in a way, because finally the artist sees the rewards to his work.
Okay, so it's important because we need that end of the market. It's not generally being stimulated enough as it should. Is that the consensus?
What do you mean?
Well, that higher end where they're spending a lot of money, it's difficult to get the buyers over here, or it's better for our economy to have them coming and spending in this higher end of the market for this period.
Yes. Obviously, absolutely. Because the same collectors who buy high end also buy emerging artists as well.
A lot of those really, really top collectors. We've seen this recently with some of our young artists. We've seen this with some of our young artists. I've gone to the collectors' homes and it's just fantastic that a young artist 2 years out of the Royal College of Art will be hanging with a Lichtenstein or an old master. And so that's fantastic. And I think for London, Frieze does that so well, because it's, you know, for this week, it's kind of the center of the universe. I mean, there is always that problem, though, that the fashion art, you know, or what, you know, the billionaires will chase. And you I don't think you can do anything about that. I think it's forever been thus.
Well, I think that's disappearing with the economy. I mean, that's one of the upsides of the economic crisis, is that it does get rid of the investor art collector. In some respects, they disappear from that middle bracket.
They've got less money to play with.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just leaves it open to, you know, artists that are doing well on a museum level, and collectors understanding that as being what they want to buy into, really, and support. So,
well, that's what really caught me about Stuart's private phone call on the bus, which I was vagging on, was that you were saying that you know, Hearst wasn't selling. It wasn't, you know, he'd made a lot of work. People felt. Am I allowed to quote you?
I can't remember what I said. You were saying
You said he'd produced a lot of work, and so people were feeling that by buying it, that they thought it was something special, individual, and then they were seeing that it was making so many of them that he stopped moving.
Well, I think what I was talking about is actually this idea of the art speculator in that middle market, and people buying actually probably for the wrong reason, because they didn't really love the work and they thought it'd be a great investment, etc. And actually they bought, you know, okay, let's use Hearst as an example. Maybe it's a bad one, but a spot painting, so did everybody else. What are they really worth? We don't really know. Gagosian will put spot paintings in all his galleries next year and try and reinvigorate the market. But at the end of the day, a lot of people who bought that work to show off in their kind of trendy apartment with their hedge fund bonus are probably feeling a little bit let down and are hopefully going off and doing something else.
Because there's so many of them.
Well, it's not just that there's so many of them. I mean, these people were just buying the most obvious sort of big brand names. And
in the same way they buy a car or a house.
Yeah, fashion. Yeah. Art as fashion.
Yeah, they weren't making that. You know, when we see young collectors at the gallery, there are people buying work because they love the art, you know, and at a lower price point, actually, underneath that mid-market. That's the only reason people are buying stuff.
It's interesting. What area of the market is Ebb and Flow aiming at?
We are emerging art, so, I mean, all our guys are out of college in the last 5 years. So again, we're all very young and upcoming.
Okay, so you're looking to set those trends that people then follow?
Well, hopefully. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, we went into it thinking that there's so many platforms for measuring up, but we thought, let's make a platform that's, you know, on a world level in terms, you know, we've got a massive space, we've got everything's up and running. And so we thought, we identified 10 artists that we thought that we could back. And in terms of backing, you know, we offer them studio space, we offer them advance for any piece they want to do, that type of jazz. So yeah, that's the level we're working at. We want to build this next level coming in, rather than just kind of follow trends.
Because a lot of people have commented on, you know, Saatchi's buying power, because as soon as he turns attention to something, everybody's like, wow, he picked that, it must be something worthwhile, you know, which is good, but I wish there were more powers like that, you know, who just pick something out of nowhere. Like, he picked stuff from Saatchi online, which is just, you know, free for everyone to upload, and he said, I want that in the show. And by doing that, you know, he creates the artist, as you said, Frame did for Laurie. And so, do we have enough of those trendsetters? I mean, does Freeze tend to... do people take risks when you go around?
I think there's way more collectors now than there were back in when obviously Saatchi was so important in terms of defining who people would look at. You know, I think now you have so many collectors following that the same sort of scenario where they have their own museum space, or they have... or they show their collection within a public arena. So I think, you know, we're in a better situation, or artists are in a better situation, and they're not just relying on one mega collector.
Now, so more people are buying.
Oh, London has some fabulous support here. Mm. I mean, you think about the Outset Fund, what Candida Gertler has done. She's, you know, she's incredible. You think about what Anita Zablodovich has done with 176.
What's that?
Well, she has her foundation, Anita does, and she's supporting young emerging artists and putting on you know, exhibition programs, and you know, they have a fantastic buying budget, and every place in the world you see Anita going and searching for artists, and you know, and she and her husband really spend their money.
Mm. And they also supported Zoo, didn't they?
Yeah.
And they support Sunday.
So. And you have Fatima Malecki and David Roberts, and you know, London has a lot of really great support, and some are more quiet, but you know, they are also extremely busy, so to compete for their time, their visual time is also, you know, it. They're, you know, seeing you, or, you know, it's very hard.
Are more people studying art? Are we getting more artists? Is it becoming more of a safe option, an advisable? I mean, in the old days, I mean, I know parents would have been freaked out if their child wanted to study art as opposed to dentistry and engineering, because it was less of a secure future. But now I think people see it as a viable option, and I wondered if you're just finding there's more and more graduates and more graduate shows, larger numbers, not.
I don't know. I mean, I think it might go back a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got the tuition fees there. You know, I think it's going to go the other way. Actually, when I was studying, my parents didn't want me to go anywhere near art, because the only artist they could think of was Van Gogh. He chopped his ear off, and you're going to end up drinking meths in a bedsit. luckily, you know, at the end of the 90s, I could hold up, oh, Damien Hirst just sold this for loads of money. Maybe I'm not that crazy, Mum. I'm going to art school. But I think actually, you know, with what we've seen with the market writing itself, etc., etc., maybe it isn't that sort of shortcut that kids are looking for, you know. And I think it's part of that generational kind of idea that I'm going to be on Big Brother, I'm going to be famous, I'm going to put some blue tack on the wall, I'm going to get £1 million. maybe it doesn't work like that, and maybe people have seen that now, so people are kind of reevaluating that. But it's not to say there's some brilliant work coming out of most of the colleges at the moment. The last few years have been so vibrant, and you know, particularly in video work, actually I've seen such great stuff.
Yeah. What about you, Cynthia? Do you think there's more and more art students?
I don't think there's more and more
coming from other countries, perhaps like the Middle East. And
yes, that I think is what I mean. Because as Stuart was saying, the tuition fees will have an impact here. It has to. But I would agree also that some of the work that's coming out the last few years has been amazing. But that's why it's great to travel if one can, you know, to the various art fairs or to the biennales or, you know, to places like Turkey and China. I haven't been able to go to China yet, but India, and because there is such a vibrancy now and such a positive attitude in so many countries that artists can make work.
I think young artists are choosing to move around as well. I mean, they're not just going to college in London now. They can go to Frankfurt or other parts of Europe for their education, and the fees makes that possible. But we're still cheaper than the States, I think, for education.
Oh, you're a lot cheaper than the States, yes.
So we get a lot of US students coming here. Especially, I mean, I teach on the curating course at Goldsmiths, and we certainly have a very international intake of students there.
Well, I mean, it's always been that international students could afford the fees, so there was always that contingent What do you think?
I mean, I think there is the flip side to that is, I mean, as I agree that there's been an influx of talent in the last years, but my worry is that talent will be taken over by students who could only just afford that fee rather than the ones who their portfolio was good enough to get in. And there might be this balance for institutions to rock this the whole time. So that's a worry.
Because I remember when I was at university, all the foreign students were rich because they're the only ones who could afford to come from abroad. Is it still like that?
Well, I guess so, yeah. Mm. I mean, it's a fee thing, but...
Yeah. Unless
now that's going to be the same for everyone, isn't it?
But scholarships, like Royal Academy.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I think maybe like the Royal Academy will sort of hold its own.
No? Yeah. Well, the Royal Academy is now free, so it's the place to go to if you want.
Great. It's interesting what you were saying, Cynthia, about going abroad and going to places like India and China, because when I go around the Frieze often, I feel that it's a bit of a Eurovision Song Contest kind of thing where each country is represented by their booth. So I see, oh, this is the Brazilian gallery, this is the token one from Turkey, here's the one from India. And somehow you expect that artwork to represent what's coming out of that country at the moment, even though it's not billed anywhere as being such. But because, you know, there is this one token booth for particularly... Well, it seems like that. Do you get the same feeling? Or
Well, I mean, I suppose all art fairs will try and... They want to have a large demographic, don't they? So it's important for them to look for the best galleries within those countries. Obviously, if you're a gallery in London, the competition is huge. If you're a gallery in Berlin, it's even bigger. Mm. If you come from somewhere that nobody's heard of or another country, then it's maybe there's not so much competition and maybe... you're more likely to be represented in the fair. Whether that represents a country, I don't know, because it's probably, if you're an international gallery in one of those countries, you're more likely to be showing an international range of artists from Europe as well as your own country.
Mm. Yeah, that's strange. I always find that strange as well. So you go to a Brazilian gallery and they've got some English artwork. So there's this kind of dynamic. I mean, the fair is an entity that you have to understand itself. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you go around asking yourself, why is this happening? Why is that happening? So really, there should be a guide to the Frieze, don't you think?
Yeah, that'd be nice. I mean, you know, the one thing I wanted to touch on about fair is that fairs are getting just so important because collectors aren't as rich as before. So if they're going to spend X amount, they need to make sure that they're spending on the right things. So they've got an opportunity to see what's available. And so again, with bringing other countries in, it's a good idea because you think, oh, well, actually, I've seen everything in England. What's going on in Lima or what's going on in Cuba or something like that? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's an important aspect to this fair. And again, as you going back to your question, is if there is a sort of guide of where this gallery exists in their own market, that would probably be much more helpful.
I mean, there's nothing stopping Ebb and Flow producing their own pamphlet, a renegade pamphlet that they give out the front, a guide to the Frieze, and as people come in, they've got this artwork, which is a pamphlet, which is a comment on the fair or a guide to the fair.
Yeah, well, we've snuck into the Frieze map, so, you know, so that's okay.
What's the Frieze map?
It's just a kind of a map of London outside of Frieze, and it goes with the VIP thing. It's just so they know that it's actually other galleries out there doing things.
So. Okay, so they've earmarked the galleries to go and see. Yep. I remember Zoo did a brilliant version of that for the east of London, and you even had art galleries in club toilets, you know, that they had marked on their map. And I thought that was really useful because people come to East London for the first time, probably. It's not the moneyed side of town, let's face it. And so people coming over from West London for themselves might feel like a tourist.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's a shame.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is also, I mean, you look at the importance of art fairs. I mean, something like a gallery week for East London would be great during Frieze, you know. Yeah. I mean, I think it's everyone's kind of thoughts in the back is having this full tour that goes on during the week.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't. I mean, even a gallery weekend or week would happen. Would be better to happen at a different time than Frieze, because there is also this over.
Yes. Yeah.
I
fair
mean,
enough.
If you go to Berlin, I mean, the gallery weekend happens in May, and I mean, the traditional art fair weekend is in September.
September.
So.
Because you're the collectors, particularly the international collectors, they are so busy.
Yeah.
Their program is just, you know, they're booked from 8 a.m. until midnight.
A collector.
The collectors that are...
Well, everybody who's coming into town, there's so much on.
Mm. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I've decided I'd like to start some kind of... Vespa service to go from opening to opening, because tomorrow night, for example, I've got a 5 or 6, and we're all like, how are we going to get there? Can you ride in high heels? No, I can't ride in high heels. What are we going to do? You know, there's all that. But the interesting part of the fair I wanted to talk about was not just the sales, but was the thought. The thought, each year they have the Frieze talks, and there's certain topics and things that we look at, and I love this idea of people coming together to pool their thought, and I wish that was a much larger part of this London week, this unofficial London week that we're discussing. What have you you know, personally ever taken from a talk or thought about the talks?
I've usually been too busy to go to them during that week, so I can't really comment. But,
nothing.
The same. There's so
the
much
program
going
looks
on.
Amazing. Yeah.
It looks great, and you'd love to make it there. But
well, we've recorded them. Resonance records them every year, and they get podcast. I mean, last year we had a guy, an Iranian, doing neo-neorealist film talk, and then they were looking at the comic in art, you know, and they were talking about the renegade in art. There's so many topics that they look at, which are really interesting, mm-hmm. and these are the things that usually go on within university walls, which we might not get access to. And I feel there's not enough debate and forum around art in London. Mm-hmm. So I would like to see that expanded, perhaps.
Outside of the freeze time.
Maybe, yes, perhaps.
Or maybe, interesting, if universities opened up their lecture programme to other artists.
Or to other people.
Or to other people, yeah everybody.
See, that educational element, mm-hmm. The talks that we're discussing, that is so important for the general public. Mm. Because I think as gallerists and as people in the industry, I mean, unless we're on the panel, we probably don't have time to go because we're probably running around doing all our stuff. But for the general public, that's extremely important. And if they buy their ticket to go to the fair and then they get to go to 5 panel talks, that's fantastic.
I think it also adds value to art because it starts you thinking about, you know, the purpose of art, the vehicles that art uses. It helps you understand the language more. You know, it brings value to art. So I would like to see, you know, perhaps galleries like yours putting on talks as well as openings so that we could come along and have our minds stimulated through words as well as visuals, sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we just finished doing a talk with design over the design festival, and the kind of how design's becoming more the line between fine art and design is blurring. We did a talk like that, and I think it is important because you've got the space. And I mean, I don't see why galleries don't do it more, because most of the time it's just 4 walls. You could put something in there and have a talk in the meantime.
Yeah, and goodness knows I know enough.
I mean, there are logistics though. I mean, involved in that of advertising and marketing talks, of paying people to come and talk. I mean, we have done talks in the past for exhibitions, and when we've invited curators, and they've also done talks. But sometimes it's not so well attended. If you have a gallery in the East End, and it does already, you're offering a cultural thing for free. If you're a private gallery, you're opening your doors to the public.
But you did that talk on Dennis Oppenheim.
Exactly.
Packed.
Yes. I mean, we had lots. Yeah, yeah. Of course. But we got Dennis over from New York.
But you yourself gave a talk when they had the turpentine installation.
That's right.
And that was packed.
Yeah.
So
that was.
You
took a lot of hard work. And we had lots of support from the Arts Council for that show back then.
No, I agree.
But
with you.
I mean, it takes that sort of momentum to organise these things. I think the budget for that show was £15,000. Normally, we wouldn't have a budget for that. So to be able to replicate that on a showly basis would be a huge financial drain to the gallery.
A showly basis,
I like that. That's how my whole life works at the moment. Show by show, yeah.
Sounds very vaudeville.
Yeah.
So I suppose there is a concern is that you put on a talk and maybe not enough people come and you think, there's no point doing this. But often, you know, the London Diary anyway is full because, you know, we're a very cultural city. People find it, you know, it's very busy. We've all got stuff to do. Mm. But I think if you had a regular beat of shows, of talks, and you found a way for it to cost less or be sponsored, I think that would be a very beneficial thing for London at large and you by default. So I'll leave you with that thought. So I think we're coming to the end of our spot now here on The Frieze. We'll be back tomorrow with another discussion, more interviews and another prismatic look at the fair that's taking London by storm at the moment. So I'll thank you all for joining us.